want a life that's sparkplug coffee fragilistic expialidocious? You want to know what that means? Well, it means you make a wish for your mornings to be practically perfect in every way, and a magical wind takes your wish to the heavens and makes it come true. Or, where a wind is lacking, you can just go to sparkplugcoffee.com. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. And you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it or take advantage of Sparkplug's autopilot set-it-and-forget-it delivery to keep your mornings as orderly as a British bank. And right now, Sparkplug has a special offer for Top 100 listeners. You can get 10% off your next coffee order if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word, the number 100. The order applies to any size coffee order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? A Sparkplug coffee fragilistic expialidocious morning is one click away. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Well done, Governor.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey there, Chimney Sweeps, and thank you very much for downloading the next 132 Project, the weekly classic movies podcast. We chatted about the 123 pictures that made the American Film Institute's Great Movies list in 1998 and 2007 long ago. So now our mission is to review every movie ever made. It might take us a while to accomplish that. They're gaining on us.
One week at a time.
We're not gaining on them every single day. Netflix alone is ruining us in this venture. Careful if you don't groove on spoilers. They're coming at you very soon. I am the guy who has never said spitspalt until right this very second, Ryan Ellis. And here's my practically perfect co-host, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
You and Mary Poppins and maybe Julia Roberts. We just watched her do an interview on The Late Show. No one else is practically perfect. All right, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture. Wait a minute. Emily Blunt, obviously, is one I should have included in that, shouldn't I? She's playing Mary Poppins a few days from this podcast getting released. All right, so the coming attractions trivia. Julie Andrews won Best Actress for this, her very first movie. How many other women won Best Actress in their big screen debut?
Counted three. Marlee Matlin for Children of a Lesser God. Barbara Streisand for her first time out for Funny Girl. And a woman I've never heard of, Shirley Booth, who won for Come Back Little Sheba in 1952.
The famous Shirley Booth.
So famous.
So four women in total. No man has ever won Best Actor in his first movie, but there have been a few Best Supporting Actor winners, including Harold Russell, in The Best Years of Our Lives, which we covered a few years ago. And there have been a lot of women who've won in their first ever movie for Best Supporting Actress, including fairly recently with people like Lupita Nyong'o and Jennifer Hudson.
Well, as we've pointed out before, the competition for Best Actress and Best Supporting Actress is easier because there are so few good roles for women in Hollywood that the competition isn't nearly as stiff as Best Actor or Best Supporting Actor.
All right, Sherry Bobbins, Simpsons reference, was nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. And I remember when we first started talking about those, you were a little surprised this didn't make it.
I'm surprised it didn't make it. And even after having watched it, that some of the musicals that did make it beat this movie.
Mm-hmm, including one from that very same year, which we'll talk about through this podcast,
most
I'm sure.
Most definitely.
Yeah. Buena Vista, which is Disney's banner. It was really a Disney movie. But if you look on the Box Office Mojo list, it'll say BV for all the stuff that they own now, and Star Wars properties, Marvel properties. Well, they certainly own this one, too. Anyway, Disney released it in August 1964. It made the Mouse House a murderous amount of moolah. But Bev, you probably should remind people what the movie's about, even though they probably know, because it's a pretty well-known story. But tell us the skinny.
Julie Andrews is Mary Poppins, a magical nanny who floats down from the clouds to look after the miscreant children of the Banks family. The film is then a series of Edwardian London fever dreams filled with songs, class mixing, and child neglect. What plot there is makes little sense, but everyone's quite happy at the end, so I guess everything worked out. Something to do with kites.
Good snark job there. Or in a nutshell, hired help leaves job without giving notice or even saying goodbye.
It's true. They still are going to need a new nanny because Mr. Banks got his job back. But I guess the idea is Mrs. Banks hung her suffragette ribbon on the kite, so she's done with all that. Good message, Disney.
I don't know if Disney was known for his advanced thinking with women back in those days. All right, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers. 100% of critics like this movie. 47 fresh, of course, 0 rotten. 100, huh?
That is impressive.
And 86% of audiences. So the movie is beloved by those people, along with those who went to see it, because it's 27th on Box Office Mojo's top 300 adjusted for inflation. It was actually 1964's third biggest hit. My Fair Lady, here's the first mention of that, was number one that year. But it's way back, about, I don't know, $150 million adjusted, less than Mary Poppins has made, but that is the re-release situation. But 27th, it's pretty high. And again, the Disney thing, look how many movies Disney owns. Some of them like this are an actual Disney property, not to say that the Marvel stuff isn't, but really think of it's Marvel made the movie and Disney distributed it. Star Wars is made by the Star Wars people, distributed by Disney.
This is a Disney movie through and through, to the point where Walt Disney himself was quite invested, worked quite closely on this movie.
He won more Oscars than anyone in history. This was the only time he was nominated for actually producing a movie. He was always an executive producer, but this time he was considered a regular producer. As we've talked about before, executive producers don't get nominated for Oscars.
And this is reportedly amongst the favorite of his films that he ever produced.
Right, which is, again, hard to believe. I guess I'm giving away what I think of it. I'm not a huge
fan. I know, you're really going to dump on
it. I don't dislike it. It's just overrated. What are your thoughts?
So, there's a lot to admire about it.
Yes, there is.
The songs are still out of this world. Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke really are extraordinary. But even the power of nostalgia couldn't save it from that 2-hour, 20-minute running time. Particularly starting around the 30-minute mark, every scene starts to feel like it's twice as long as it needs to be. I appreciate that there are people who love it just because it was the movie they grew up with. And there's so much charm to the individual scenes, and if you have a selective memory about it, it can seem like one of the greatest films ever made. But sitting down and watching all of it at once, not just because you caught it on TV, not because you were watching clips, it kind of feels like a stretch in this day and age.
I'll quote Krusty the Clown, "That just kept going."
It just keeps going on. Scene after scene that, forgive me, but they could have just halved the length of most of the scenes of the film. And you mentioned when we were watching it that it's so unusual for Walt Disney. Most of the films that he made before this, certainly most of the animated films he made, had a really nice trim length, sometimes well under 90 minutes. I'm thinking of Dumbo, which was one of my favorites growing up.
Barely more than an hour long.
Right. Keeping it short and sweet, whereas Mary Poppins just seems indulgently long.
The movie could have been 90 minutes long, rather than the 215 or so that it is.
There's no plot to speak of. The plot could fit literally an episode of The Simpsons. We talked about The Simpsons parody.
There's Sherry Bobbin's episode. Captures everything that this one does. It's one of their best episodes ever. We're going to quote it a lot through the podcast. We've already mentioned it a few times.
And it's an homage that's done with love. I think we can say that the creators of The Simpsons clearly loved Mary Poppins when they did their send-up of
They really
Mary
captured
Poppins.
The tone, especially the one where they're requesting to their parents what kind of nanny they want.
Yeah.
Apart from the dialogue being different, or lyrics, I should say. It's the same song, really. But speaking of songs, there's way too many. I guess that's typical for most musicals. They don't ever stop singing. I've never been a big fan of that. Singing in the Rain, Wizard of Oz have plenty of songs, but they don't seem like they're constant. It doesn't seem like it's the only thing that they've got going for them. They could have just cut them all together, but at least make the songs themselves shorter. Mary Poppins herself doesn't sing until 32 minutes in. Now, she doesn't really come into the movie until, I didn't look, but it was a little ways in. And she's not the only one that sings. Everyone seems to have a number, and maybe that's part of the problem. The chimney sweep thing towards the end, except for the fact they end up in the Banks' house, why is that in there? It does not need to be in there. It doesn't serve any purpose at all.
I think that the true standout of Waste of Time is the Uncle Albert sequence where they're laughing and they're on the ceiling.
Yeah.
It goes on and on and on for days. And then the very worst part is that the whole point is that when you laugh, you start to float. That's a sweet thing. That's a very fun childhood fantasy that you might be able to just fly. There's a charm to the concept to begin with. But then the whole point is that they're telling jokes and the jokes are making them laugh. So
dad jokes. Laugh.
They're the worst jokes. There's nothing funny about them. No dad is laughing. No kid is even laughing at these jokes. They're so dumb.
What do you call the other leg?
Oh. And then you hear that same joke. You have to take a long walk to get to the end of that joke. And you have to hear it like 3 times throughout the course of the film.
Maybe more than 3.
Just write a funny joke. That's all I'm saying.
Well, I haven't seen this movie since, I think, the mid-90s. It's probably one of those, I don't remember this specifically, but I think it's one of those I watched on videotape, and it was the whole sort of, I'm going to watch all the great movies and also all the Oscar winners. So this, of course, is Julie Andrews winning for Best Actress. And I don't remember what I thought of it. It was so long ago. I guess I've already made it clear I'm a mild thumbs down
So you
because
didn't.
of some of the problems. But if Disney was the merciless editor that he was for, like you say, the Snow Whites and the Dumbos of the world, where they would cut entire sequences out of that that everyone thought were great, but Walt said, doesn't move the story along. Why did he not have that ability in this movie, which won for best editing
That
at the
is.
Oscars?
I will argue against that. People often mistake editing with special effects, and the special effects in this movie are exceptional. Absolutely. And it won for special effects, right? So, totally 1000% deserves that Oscar. Editing, that's a joke. It never should have won editing. And I kind of wonder, maybe Walt Disney was getting old. So, maybe he just, I don't know, was giving up on that cutthroat part of himself and giving in to the attachment that he had for every single moment of this film. And whatever his instinct was to cut or not cut something, the film made a fortune. People loved it. People still love it. Now, did you ever watch it as a kid growing up?
I don't think so.
Okay, because I did. This was one of those films in my family. I think it was on TV a lot. But it was just kind of a presence when we were growing up. I saw this movie a lot along with Bedknobs and Broomsticks. I think of all of these David Tomlinson movies, you know, when I was looking him up, I was like, wow, these were all the films I grew up with
He was
because
in
it's
Bedknobs
like
and Broomstick.
Bedknobs and Broomsticks. Also, The Love Bug was another movie that we watched a zillion times when I was a
Those two
kid.
movies, a lot of the people involved in this one made those two, Love Bug and Bedknob.
It's not even just the film that I grew up with, but the general sentiment of these films that were being made around this time are very much what I grew up with. But even nostalgia couldn't, for me, rescue this movie. I enjoyed lots about it. I did really love the songs. I'm a little more forgiving of musicals in general than you are, so it doesn't bother me that they're singing. I'm like, saying that's the whole point of the movie. Songs are wonderful. I love watching people sing and dance. Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke both are beyond perfect career
Her
performances.
being perfect, I'll give you that. Well, it's a little strong to say perfect, but great, sure. I was surprised about him because I've always heard he was miscast. And again, not remembering the movie very well, I had to go by what they said and thought, well, he probably is. Why isn't this an actual Englishman playing this role? But they wanted some big-name American actors, so they had that for box office appeal back home in the States. Although, ironically, he was a TV actor. And this was still absolutely, well, hell, even until fairly recent history. A TV actor in a movie is not really a draw because if you can see him for free, why would you pay to see him on the big screen? So that's actually weird logic. And yes, his accent is not very good, but his charisma is great. His talent is very good.
His physical comedy, I mean, he could rival Buster Keaton
That's what he
and
was
Charlie
known for
Chaplin.
on the TV show, too, the Dick Van Dyke show.
But it's a marvel to just see the way he moves in the character. First as Bert and as Mr. Dawes, again, is a completely different physical character. I think he's wonderful.
I don't know I would have known that it was him, except I read that it was him playing that character. You said the physicality when we first see him, that whole little bit where he can't walk off a step that's about 6 inches high.
Like a normal step height.
But otherwise, I think he does a great job in that character. I don't think he sounds or looks anything like himself. He's going to be in the remake, which is going to come out in a few days from when we post this podcast. Julie Andrews apparently is not. I don't see her name on the cast list. He knew he was miscast, and a lot of people have criticized him for being miscast. You could have had a lot of big names do the role. You could have a lot of big names now. I don't know why they picked him, apart from what I said is supposedly the reason, but I just think that's weird logic when he's not even a movie star to begin with. He's a TV star.
And it's not even like they blew the budget on a star because this is Julie Andrews' first movie. Of course, she was a theater star. She had made her name playing Eliza Doolittle. Was it on Broadway or was it in London?
Probably London because that's an English production and it's also two English stars, Rex Harrison and her. Maybe it was Broadway. In any case, that's where she got her fame. And she wanted that role. She logically should have had it. But Warners went with a big name star in Audrey Hepburn. And we talked about that movie years ago on the Tappenheimer Project. And she was fine. She didn't sing any of the songs. Julie Andrews would have sung the songs
Yeah,
if she'd
Marty
been in it.
Noxon? Marty, not Marty.
Marnie Nixon.
Marnie Nixon?
So instead, Andrews gets this role. And I think one of the reasons she won the Oscar was as a sympathy vote. I looked at the other nominees a couple hours ago and I don't recognize any of those movies. Oh, I did see The Unsinkable Molly Brown a long time ago. Debbie Reynolds was in that, but I haven't seen the other three movies, so I can't even compare, but it just feels like it was a sympathy vote for not getting the other role. Harrison actually referenced her when he won his Oscar that night. So actually, they were the two that won, ironically, the same year. Him for My Fair Lady, her for this, but they should have been both of them in My Fair Lady.
And he was in the theater production. Like, he played with Julie. Yeah.
In My Fair Lady.
Yeah.
So Mary Poppins is set in April 1910, obviously in London. And right away, we get Dick Van Dyke playing Bert. He is a narrator breaking the fourth wall. He walks over to 17 Cherry Tree Lane. And we also see, of course, Mary coming in on a cloud while fixing her makeup. A lot of fantastical stuff going on here, but okay, fine. And one of the lines is, what's to happen all happened before. So Mary keeps floating in to help people, I guess, and then floating out when her work is done and not telling anyone she's leaving.
She ghosts everyone. She's kind of like a ghost.
She's a witch!
So I found a theory online that Mary Poppins was Bert's nanny when he was a child. She doesn't age, but he does.
Oh. They seem to have a romantic history.
Well, I don't know how much I agree with this theory, although there's some reasoning. How does he know her? How does she know him? Why do they have this chemistry and affection towards one another? He never seems to question her magic and seems quite at home in her world. And there's a line in Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious about how when he was a lad, he didn't speak until someone taught him this magical word.
It's hard to believe him not speaking.
Well, exactly.
Never shuts
but
up.
It's because Mary Poppins was his nanny and didn't just fix him, but fix him and then some. But then it's hard to believe that somebody who's clearly as working class as he was would have had a nanny growing up as well. There's a history between Bert and Mary Poppins.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of nannies, Elsa Lanchester plays Katie Nana, who's quitting because these kids are so bad to deal with. She's best known, of course, for playing the Bride of Frankenstein. It's funny how little screen time she had in that movie as the Bride of Frankenstein, the Bride of the Monster, I guess, and yet still her most famous role. I'd forgotten she was in this film, actually. And because she quits, she puts the banks in a bad situation, but then all the unemployed nannies who are looking for work or looking to try to take this job after her are blown away. Wind hates the working class. Obviously, Mary had a hand in that. And then the kids meeting Mary are surprised by her flying and going up the banister. They take it really quite well. Considering she's doing these things, have they seen people with magic powers before?
The whole world is kind of a Mary Poppins world. There's something magical about the world just from the get-go.
And they jump into paintings.
They jump into paintings.
That sequence could have gone entirely, too. The only reason that sequence needs to be there at all is so they can show off, and because that makes them all bond more, especially the kids with her.
It's not a bad sequence. It just should have been half the length.
Or unnecessarily.
Yeah, just do the song. The race could have lasted minutes instead of 10. I zoned out. I don't care if Mary Poppins and her carousel horse win this horse race. And like you said, Disney prior to this wasn't really fussy about cutting scenes no matter how much they spent on it, no matter how much time the artists spent making these scenes look amazing. He wasn't shy about cutting them. I think there's some lines later in the movie where they reference the race, but it doesn't seem like it'd be that much of a stretch to cut around it. I agree. They should have just had the Holiday with Mary song.
Movies have had stuff stay in them that refer to something else, and you don't know what they're talking about. There's an octopus that's mentioned in The Goonies, which was in the movie, but they cut it out. Ferris Bueller, he says, we ate pancreas. Well, they didn't do that in the movie. It was deleted. So This happens sometimes. There's all kinds of continuity mistakes and errors in movies that we let slide and don't really care about or don't notice until after watching it many times. The flip side, of course, to all this magic and goofiness, I guess, is Mr. Banks, who won't be shaken from his routine. Comes home at 6. He's got a drink at 6:02. He's got something else going on at 6:03 exactly. I think his character's okay, but I don't really believe his arc. His tight ass really needs loosening. That's obviously true, but this much. And at the end where he's being so silly with the bank manager and all those guys. And of course, it has to work out, even though he's fired. Naturally, it has to work that he gets his job back. Even though I didn't remember that happening.
No reason.
I knew that was going to happen.
Yeah.
At the very end. That, oh, we'll bring you back on, Banks. All right.
It makes no sense whatsoever. You have to give it to David Tomlinson, though, who plays Mr. Banks. He just plays this inflexible drag with a lot of pathos. He could so easily be a villain, but instead you actually do kind of feel bad for him when the bank strips him of his hat, his lapel flower, his umbrella. His expression in that scene is true pathos, and you really root for him in that moment where I think in a lot of films he would just be the straight-up bad guy. And you could say that he's the protagonist of the film because he's the only character to significantly change in any way. And it's his change of heart that brings the film to its conclusion.
It's funny that Julie Andrews won an Oscar for this because we've talked about it in other podcasts, Dustin Hoffman and Rain Man, which is a great performance, but his character barely changes. It's Cruz's character that changes.
Yeah, she's not a traditional protagonist so much as she is the force of nature influencing our protagonist. She changes not at all throughout the course of the film. and it would have been quite easy and tempting then for the film to just skip the subtle touches that we do get from Julie Andrews' performance at the end of the film, where we, the audience, get to see the subtle expressions of sadness and regret that she now has to leave the Banks family. She's not indifferent like the wind.
Mm-hmm.
She cares, even though she's really more of a force of nature than a character that we're meant to be invested in.
She's not a good nanny, though, in many ways.
No, Mr. Banks, child neglect.
Mr. Banks should be upset at all the chimney sweeps in his house, for one thing, which she allows to happen. And she just doesn't really do the kind of job she should with these kids. They always seem to be put in danger with her and with Bert, for that matter.
The very first day that she's in charge of the children, she jumps them into a painting and then is like, go, go,
right,
find the park.
So she can canoodle with Bert.
Yes!
If this was an R-rated movie...
She's kids for like an hour and they're notorious for running away.
If this was an R-rated movie, she and Bert would be doing something a lot more than just...
Do you think?
Walking around.
Do you buy their romance with one another?
No, but they have a lot of affection for each other. It would be sexual if it could be sexual.
That's new. An X-rated version of Mary Poppins. That's what we want here.
Surely Hustler has done that at some point in their magazine.
I'm sure if we Googled it, then the internet would provide.
They did for Wizard of Oz. I just watched People versus Larry Flint again a few weeks ago. And, of course, they show the cartoon. The Wizard of Oz characters are all getting it on very graphically. Well, this being Disney, there had to be animation, which is one of the many things that the author of the book, P.L. Travers, who's portrayed in Saving Mr. Banks... Pretty solid movie with Tom Hanks and Emma Thompson. Hanks playing Disney and Thompson playing Travers. She didn't love the idea of there being songs, and she certainly thought there were too many. She did not like the animation at all, and I think she had problems with almost all of it. I'm not saying that movie is entirely accurate, but I've read online, beyond just Saving Mr. Banks, that she had real problems with what they were doing, what Disney was doing.
She spent the rest of her life fighting a sequel from happening.
And they finally have one now coming up this week, 54 years later.
Over her dead body, literally.
But I think the interesting thing with that attitude, and Stephen King and The Shining is another example of this, I guess you have a right to be disappointed if your property has been messed with in a way you didn't want. But once you sell the rights to a movie studio, it's not yours anymore. Now, she was allowed to contribute to the way that they did things, so she should be glad about that. She wouldn't know this. She's not somebody who ever knew anything about movies, and Hollywood especially. She's a British author being invited over to one of the most powerful guys in the world at that point. This is not your movie. It's his. If you don't like it, then just quit. Don't work with him if it's so bad.
Well, it took him years to secure the rights because of this very reason that she didn't trust Disney to stay true to her vision of Mary Poppins. But it just happened that Walt Disney's daughters were crazy about her books, and that's why he pressed and pressed until he got the rights. And she said that the two things she was most concerned about is that they would A, turn it into a cartoon, and B, turn it into a musical, and they did both of those things. She had, I think, in her contract, the right to basically provide notes, and they kindly let her provide notes, and then they ignored each and every one of them and did exactly what they wanted. Of course, she got paid, but I kind of get the impression that she may have been misled about how they were going to treat the material. In the original Mary Poppins, Mary Poppins wasn't sweet. She wasn't this benevolent, magical creature. She was rather pompous. She was rather strict. She was a very different character.
She's actually more stern than I thought she was going to be.
Yeah,
because, again,
I agree.
Not having seen it for so long.
I forgot how
she's
much,
not
yeah.
as much as it says she should have been, according to the books. Yeah, okay, fine. But I just thought she was going to be a little more likable. Not that she's unlikable. I just thought she's going to be a little bit more so, considering I'm reading about how Travers wanted her to be more the way she wrote her.
In 2018, where there's just this general devotion to airy fairy magic and trust in the universe, it's actually refreshing to see a force of magic who is just as devoted to discipline and responsibility as she is to happiness. It's actually kind of refreshing to see that.
Well, I said she's a bad nanny. It's not entirely true. She does right by the kids plenty of times, including giving them medicine that they certainly don't want to drink.
Making them clean their room.
Well, that's early on. But when she gives them the medicine, it's a really nice touch that I liked a lot. I don't know how exactly they did it back in 1964. It'd be so easy now with post-production digital things you can do whatever you want to. But she pours medicine for both kids and for herself, and each one of them is a different color. It's a really good touch. We just talked about the animation. An animation in a live-action movie was done before this, in Anchors Away, where Gene Kelly dances with Jerry the Mouse.
And Fantasia and Song of the South.
Oh, that's right. I was supposed
to... Disney had done it.
Fantasia did it. That's right. I forgot they did that too. Some of the effects you can see literally through them and that kind of deal. But you have to understand, 1964, pretty good effects even now. considering they didn't have the advantages they have now.
I agree. I think that the combination of animation and live action actually looks really good. It doesn't look corny, at least looking back at it now. But I wouldn't say that it's better than what I remember from Song of the South. Now, of course, my memory is just going to remain my memory because that movie's next to impossible to see. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that I really am tempted to see it again.
Deeply racist.
But that movie came out at least 10 years prior.
I think it was in the 40s.
So I'm not sure if the technology was actually all that brand new, but it looks great. Their eye lines match. Everything looks rather convincing.
They interact with the cartoons, too.
They interact, at least to the point where I'm not thinking about it. It doesn't really stick out to me. There's other things, though, that are extremely bad. I'm just really thinking of that animatronic bird sitting on her finger.
Yeah.
It just looks so much like a robot or puppet that it's embarrassing and weird. But at the same time, the tone of the movie is so whimsical that, okay, the bird looks fake because it probably is supposed to look fake.
It could be. It's like the end of Blue Velvet where the bird is fake.
Yes, yes,
maybe
yes,
that's an homage exactly. by Lynch to this movie.
Mary Poppins opens with this sequence with Bert where he's talking directly to camera. So it's, listen, we get that you're watching a movie. We're here to entertain you. And then the first house he passes is the bizarre Admiral house, cannon on top. And just everything about that house is so ridiculous, fantastical, that they're setting the tone. This movie is not meant to be real. It's not meant to be taken literally. So, of course, the characters are reacting to Mary Poppins' magic, and they're impressed and they're amazed, but we as the audience accept that magic is part of this world, and there's something silly and whimsical about it. So when there's penguins serving them lunch, or she's talking to this terrible animatronic bird, you just go with it and enjoy it, because it's this creative feast. It's this great little banquet of ideas and silliness that we're not really meant to think that hard about.
What you just said is fair, but I didn't love a lot of that stuff. What I liked way less than anything else, probably, including how long the movie is itself, is the bank sequence, the whole Tuppence thing. Apparently, Walt's favorite song of all of them was Feed the Birds, which is what leads into the bank sequence. So, okay, it's not my favorite song, but I can respect that he liked it an awful lot. But they even sing in the bank, and why not? Because you sing everywhere else, and they try to scam the kid out of his money he wants to give to the bird lady. But then the bank customer's losing their minds so completely when the kid is trashing the bank and they're trying to steal from me, they all want their money out instantly. Okay, maybe it's kind of what you just said a minute ago about the movie deliberately being fake at times. Maybe they're, well, they probably are really aware of how dumb that is. But it is dumb. And it's hard to look past the fact that it seems to be just there so Banks, who works in a bank, can get fired. Oh, wait, he doesn't get fired till the end, though. That's right, he's not fired at that point.
Well, he's fired because of those events. There's never been a run on the bank in my whole life, and then there's a run on the bank today, and that's why we're going to take your hat and punch a hole in it and take your flower from
that's
your
not
lapel.
That's not what happens at the end, though, when he goes back, and then he starts doing the whole dancing around stuff, and, yeah. Oh, I like a song now.
He leaves, I think, looking for his kids, and then he finds out that Mr. Dawes wants to see him at 9 o'clock at night, and then he very dramatically walks over, and I think it's on the way he has a conversation with Bert, where Bert reminds him that he should care more.
That's in his house. I was saying all the chimney sweeps are in his house and they shouldn't be. It's just to get to that point where they have a conversation.
His house is full of ash and he's totally open to take parenting advice from a random stranger who's been gallivanting around with his miscreant children. So Bert tells him at that moment, you should take better care of your children. They're going to grow up and blah. I guess that gets through to him by the time he gets to the bank. And so when he loses his job and he really truly feels like he has nothing to lose, he suddenly goes a little crazy and starts giggling maniacally, then leaves, and then for some reason the joke he tells, which is the leg joke that you shared with us earlier, is so funny in this alternate universe that Mr. Dawes literally laughs himself to death, and then his son takes over the bank
off screen, though, by the way. They mentioned it. We don't see it.
And then his son, instead of being upset about this, is thrilled about it and gives George's job back for no reason. All those plot points are so dumb and so forced. Everything that's plot about this movie is silly that we're even discussing it, because it just seems like they could not have possibly paid less attention
to
it.
We should always have to discuss things
in movies. No, but I'm criticizing the movie for even bothering to put plot points in. Wizard of Oz is very similar, where it's really just an excuse to have this episodic series of bizarre but really highly creative and fun and silly incidents. These scenes happen, again, with something like, say, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. The plot is irrelevant in a way to the film. The film is just an excuse to spend a lot of money on costumes and write these songs and have people dance and be as wild and creative as you possibly can.
There's a plot in Willy Wonka or Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. It's all about Charlie getting the chocolate factory.
You have to admit that that takes up a very small portion of the film. The fact that they spend so much attention on each individual child and why they get extracted from the family.
Yeah, and there's a plot
Sir the factory.
To Wizard of Oz as well, where she's trying to get home.
Okay, so would you argue then that Mary Poppins is worse than those films, or those films are better than Mary Poppins?
Yes, they are.
Oh, wow.
Plot-wise and just in general. Other than the songs and some of the performances in this movie, I think it's a small failure. Maybe even a large failure. Take those things out, it's a big failure. Of course, the movie wouldn't exist if those things weren't in it, but you know what I mean.
Certainly doesn't rely on any of the proper rules of storytelling. It just makes its own rules.
If anyone were to hear me say that just now and were to say, the movie's not made for you, 44-year-old man. Right, but I've fallen under the spell of a lot of movies that are made for kids. Recently, 5 years ago, and I probably will another 10 years from now, or even 30 years from now. So that's a bad argument anyway.
As I recall, when we were doing our podcast about Wizard of Oz, you were the one defending it to me.
It helps that movie's only an hour and 40 minutes long or something like that. Overlong movies make you feel like, why am I still watching this? I have other things to do with my life. Why are you still telling your story? Get it over with. And as for the kite arc in this movie, that is set up pretty well. Early on, it's discussed, and then it's never really mentioned again until the end. Mr. Banks is playing with a kite. He's all into it. He's fixed it for the kids. Now, he'd be playing video games with the kids, I think is how it would go, wouldn't it?
He'd be running around London looking for Pokemon.
As for the cast, Julie Andrews, of course, is Mary. She got to play Maria based on this performance, and that is the third biggest hit of all time when you adjust for inflation, behind Gone with the Wind and Star Wars.
I mean, you have to give it up for her as a movie star. She has so much class and charisma, and then on top of that, the most beautiful voice, and her grace is unrivaled.
And in this girl next door kind of way, she wasn't movie star gorgeous, but she was very pretty.
Very pretty.
One of the many actors in this movie where their eyes pop off the screen. Her blue eyes just burst right through that screen at you.
When they cast her, she was pregnant. And they had to wait 6 months to get production started. Yeah, she was 3 months pregnant, but they had to put off production because they wanted her.
She was married to Blake Edwards, who did the Pink Panther movies, and also Victor Victoria that she was in, and SOB that she was in. They were married for 41 years before his death in 2010, and she's still alive and still working, mostly in a voiceover role now. She's been in the Shrek movies and other things. I think the last on-screen performance, if not the last, one of the last, were those two Princess Diaries movies she made, and they were quite a long time ago now. They were the early 2000s, maybe into the mid-2000s. The two kids, Karen Dotrice and Matthew Garber, didn't really act much after this, but they're pretty solid in the movie, I guess. They're not the greatest kids I've ever seen ever act, but they're all right. There are two fewer kids in the movie than there were in the book. I guess there's four in total. That's what I was reading online. We talked about Tomlinson being in Bedknobs and Broomsticks. He was also in Tom Jones, the Oscar winner the year before this. And My Fair Lady, we talked about earlier, won Best Picture the same year as this. This was one of the rivals for that award that night, although Dr. Strangelove should have won. Maybe even Beckett could have won as well. It was a year of interesting, diverse types of movies that were up for the big award. Glynis Johns plays Mrs. Banks. She worked for 61 years, mostly making English movies, but one thing I thought, I recognized, where I know that voice from, look her up, she played Diane's mother on Cheers. One episode, and she's pretty funny in that. And also, it's pointed out online, so I looked for this, and they're right, she never once speaks to Mary. They're on screen at the same time together once, but she never actually talks to her. I don't know if that's really significant, but it's just interesting that she's part of what hires this woman, and we never see her actually speak to her.
I cannot get to the bottom of what this movie wants us to feel about Winifred Banks.
Because she comes in singing about suffragettes. And I wouldn't say she doesn't mention it again, but it doesn't become any kind of major plot point.
It's a total major plot point. What are you talking about? It's the reason she keeps abandoning the children.
Oh, okay.
It's the reason that she's...
I tuned out.
...a negligent mother. George Banks is negligent because he cares too much about his job, and Winifred is negligent because she cares too much about the cause. But while you could very easily argue that working for the bank is not as important as your family, women's suffrage is important. And I'm bothered by the idea that she has to give up the cause to be a better mother, if that's what Disney was trying to say.
I always say when Hollywood lectures us, too, and I've mentioned this in other podcasts, don't work so hard. Go home. Be with your family. From people that work 16-hour days on a regular basis, stop telling us how to live when you guys work harder than probably most of us, or at least you work more hours than most regular people ever do. So stop that. Maybe they don't mean it to be a lecture. It's a nice sentiment, actually, but come on. Jane Darwell, this is her last movie. She was in The Grapes of Wrath, won an Oscar for that, and then also The Oxbow Incident a couple years after that with Fonda. Again, we talked about that briefly last week because we had seen it not too long before. And I guess one of the influences from this film is in Home Alone 2, Brenda Fricker also plays a bird lady, and it's very similar, as I recall, although her role is way bigger in Home Alone 2 than this one, but I think it's probably an homage to Darwell's role in this film. And then there's a cast of dozens working on sound stages. A lot of them obviously have to be talented at dancing and whatnot, the chimney sweeps especially. There's a lot of them, not just Bert doing some singing and dancing. The director, we haven't even said his name after all this time, because obviously it's Disney's movie, but Robert Stevenson, who did a lot of kids' movies in this time, including Old Yeller, which I guess maybe isn't a kids' movie per se, but Bedknobs and Broomsticks, The Love Bug, he directed all those pictures. The writers who adapted Travers' book, Bill Walsh and Don DeGrady. Walsh often produced what he wrote, because he was one of the producers on this picture, along with Walt Disney. And DeGrady worked with Disney a bunch, too. The movie's 166:1. We watched the DVD from the Toronto Public Library. They've come through for us yet again. I couldn't believe that. I thought we'd have to... Well, we did actually get a loaner from a friend of ours, but we didn't need to use it. I put it on hold, and we got it a couple days later. Sometimes that happens, and sometimes you don't get a movie for months when you put it on hold through there.
I don't think there's a lot of holds on the 1964 version of
it. I'm a little surprised, actually, because the big re-release is coming out now. We saw this movie a few weeks ago. I would have thought maybe more people would want to see it to refresh their memories going into Mary Poppins Returns. This is a great print, too. I was really impressed with how nice it looked, including all those blue eyes. The cinematographer, Edward Coleman, did Dragnet on TV. A lot of stuff with Disney. His last movie was The Love Bug. The editor, maybe this isn't his fault, but God, man, cut more out. Cotton Warburton, who cut Bedknobs and Broomsticks, The Love Bug, and lots with Stevenson and Walsh. They were obviously a team. All of them were a team.
I'm sure that you're not winning arguments with Walt Disney in the edit suite. I'm sure that when you're trying to fight to keep something short and Walt Disney is the one that wants to keep everything in the picture, mm-hmm. You lose.
But how this won an Oscar for editing, I just don't
honest to God.
Other names we haven't mentioned until right now, which we probably should have before, Richard and Robert Sherman, really famous guys who worked with Disney a bunch. Travers, no likey. I don't know if she disliked them personally, but
they
were the songwriters, yeah. And Irwin Kostal was also involved in the score, I believe, in the songs. And in Saving Mr. Banks, those two guys have a very big role. There's a ton of stuff where we see them working and Travers not liking it. There was a very long pre-production of the movie just to write the songs. That was a few years' worth of work. I would say that paid off. The songs mostly are pretty good.
They're classics. They're part of American canon.
Okay, very
now.
Good. The Wizard of Oz, Singing in the Rain, those songs are better. Other influence beyond the Home Alone 2 thing I just mentioned a minute ago, that we are getting Mary Poppins Returns 54 years later, the Emily Blunt sequel. I like her a lot. I think she's going to do a pretty good job. She was just nominated for the Golden Globe.
It's getting a lot of positive reviews.
Right. It was nominated for other Golden Globes, and I'm sure it'll get some Oscar nominations. But Julie Andrews doesn't seem to be in it. And if she's not, maybe it's, I don't want to distract from Emily's performance. It could be that. But DVD is in it. We mentioned Saving Mr. Banks already. We haven't really talked about the Simpsons episode as much as I thought we might in this, but those songs are so great. In front of a tavern, flat on his face, a booze hound named Bonnie is pleading his case. I could probably sing all the songs in that by heart, but I won't keep on going here. If you're any kind of Simpsons fan, you haven't seen that episode in a long time, or somehow haven't seen it at all, you have to watch it, because it's definitely one of their best from the standpoint of intelligence, humor, and then those great songs. Love that episode. Mary Poppins won 5 Oscars. Best Actress for Andrews, the editing. The visual effects, okay, that's reasonable. The original music and the song, but not the one you think. It was for Chim Chimmery.
Yeah, that's not the right song to give it to.
Mm-hmm.
I actually often think that about the best song Oscar in a film that's a musical that's full of songs. They never pick the song that I think they should pick.
And a lot of times the song that becomes famous in the movie isn't the one that was nominated, period, for an Oscar. It was nominated for 8 others that it didn't win. Best Picture, Best Director for Stevenson, the adapted screenplay, the cinematography, the sets, the costumes, the sound, and the adapted music. I think most of those must have gone to My Fair Lady. Certainly Picture and Director did go to My Fair Lady. The movie was entered into the National Film Registry in 2013, along with Pulp Fiction and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which are AFI films, and Roger Me, which we covered a couple years ago. Poppins was 36th in the top 100 songs with, not Chim Chim Marie, it was Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Much better.
But backwards on that, isn't it? One wins the Oscar, the other one gets the AFI recognition. Over the Rainbow from Wizard of Oz was number one on the songs list, and Mary Poppins was 6th in the top 25 musicals. Singing in the Rain was number one, as it should have been. And Mary Poppins was nominated for a ton of things that didn't make, including the top 100 laughs. All right. Did we laugh
the
once?
Leg joke.
We might have chuckled here and there, but did we laugh once?
I laughed when Winifred called all men stupid.
No, you did. That's right. You laughed at that.
That gave me a good laugh.
I can see how the movie's supposed to be funny, but it isn't really all that funny. It was nominated for the top 100 cheers, the top 100 genres in the fantasy category. I guess that makes sense. The top 50 heroes, so that would be Mary herself, and the top 100 songs with Chim Chim Marie.
So you said she was nominated for the heroes list. I have a personal theory that she is a secret hero of the proletariat by means of the British working class. She's middle class. Her clothes, her accent, her manners are decisively middle class, but she doesn't hesitate for a moment to spend time with Bert, who's definitely working class, and that's clear by his accent, by the jobs that he has. And then she lets the children spend time with him, despite society's notion that they are his better. I think the movie even suggests that maybe they're not a couple, but they have a flirtatious relationship. They take a romantic walk. He sings her a song, something that would be completely inappropriate for crossing class lines. So when you assume that she's going to have an influence on the children, certainly one of her influences will be that they will have this very egalitarian view of the working class, and they won't see themselves as better than Bert, or more specifically, the bird woman. She writes this song about the
tuppence
to buy birdseed from the bird woman. The bird woman is borderline beggar. The song is what prompts Michael to defy his father and Mr. Dawes and start a run at the bank. If Mary had the premonition to know that the bird woman would be there at the stairs when the children would be there, then she would have also had the premonition to know the consequences of Michael following her advice to give his money to that woman rather than his father's boss. I don't think the movie is subtle about suggesting the dusty old men who run the bank are greedy and obsessed with watching their money grow rather than sharing it with those who need it. And while George looks down on the bird woman, Jane and Michael, under Mary Poppins' influence, like her and want to take the same pleasures she takes in just the simple pleasures of feeding the birds. Mary Poppins doesn't approach her with pity. There is not this notion that, oh, you should be kind to them because they need it. The same way she approaches Bert with this egalitarian, you feel like she respects Bert. She respects the bird woman. I think that she has a real class consciousness.
This is one of the reasons why I cannot stand class, especially in the old English style in London and all that.
And we're fools if we think that that doesn't apply now in Canada and America.
Yeah, but England really dwelled on it, and maybe still does dwell on it.
It's more formal.
You can't talk to someone who's supposedly lower class than you. That is just stupid. It might as well be racist, even if they're all white people. God, I hate that stuff so much.
I have one more super brief theory before we wrap things up, which is that from the hallucinogenic minds of the people who created the book and the movie, each of the sequences in the film represent a different kind of high that you can get. It starts with Spoonful of Sugar. That's like when you take speed and you want to clean your whole house. That's exactly what they do. They just get messed up and just clean and clean and clean until everything's perfect. And then everything gets way too fast.
Those effects are pretty good, by the way.
Those effects are great.
For 1964.
They've aged really well. That's the speed sequence, and then it is followed by when they take LSD and just jump right into the painting and live like a whole fantasy world. And then they smoke some pot and they go visit Uncle Albert and they just giggle their way through that whole scene. Every joke that's not actually funny is hilarious. And then finally we go to the bank and everybody just does cocaine and obsesses over money in the market for a while. And that's all my elaborate theories.
So Walt made a drug movie without even trying to make it. Well, maybe he did try to make a drug movie. This is the kind of stuff that I think podcasts do best, or people that have YouTube channels, is analyze movies like this and come up with their crackpot theories, whether they're right or they're wrong. Because if you just review the movie as it is, I wouldn't say that it's boring, but anyone can do that.
I don't necessarily think I'm right, but I think that if you watch those scenes, you could draw the same conclusions as I do, that at the very least, those scenes have the spirit of each of those drugs.
All right, last thoughts on Mary Poppins, or we should say Sherry Bobbins.
It really ought to be this creative confectionery. It's a rare film that gives us with this much creativity just for creativity's sake. But the running time just stretches it just barely a little too far. There's really so much to love about this film, and I wouldn't begrudge anyone who likes it, but 2 hours and 20 minutes is way too much.
The podcast itself here has been longer than we've had a little lately, and it's put Sam to sleep, if you can hear his snoring.
It's true, our dog is snoring.
I think I've already made myself pretty clear about this movie. I didn't hate it, but I was disappointed in the fact that I didn't have the whole being won over by a good musical kind of thing, which I have been by the good ones, even the great ones. Well, especially the great ones, like Singin' in the Rain, Wizard of Oz. We liked Chicago. We liked Hairspray. We covered those last year.
Maybe you're representing the voice of somebody who simply didn't watch this film when you were kids, so you don't have any of that benefit of nostalgia.
But if it was really good, it wouldn't matter. I didn't see Singin' in the Rain until I was an adult. But the Singin' in the Rain songs, even the Wizard of Oz songs, seem to come organically from their situations. Nobody sings in real life the way they do in musicals. But when you sing constantly, look at Les Mis is a good example of this, where they sing all the time. But even when you sing as much as they do in this movie, it just feels so phony to me. I know it's inherently phony, but don't make me so aware of the fact that it's phony. Bit of a left turn here. The Library of Congress recently announced some new additions to the National Film Registry. And I want to mention this because we always talk about that if a movie made that list. We've previously covered a lot of their 25 they selected. My Fair Lady was an AFI movie, so we did that a long time ago. But we've also done Broadcast News, Brokeback Mountain, HUD, Jurassic Park, and The Shining. That's a pretty good group of movies, and all of them are on our website or on Apple Podcasts, so you can look back in our archives to find those if you haven't listened to them before. I think the biggest surprise there is The Shining, and even for that matter, Jurassic Park. How are they not already on that list? You have to wait 10 years. No movie gets on before 10 years have elapsed. Brokeback Mountain is 13 years ago. The other ones are long before that. HUD is 1963, for crying out loud. Jurassic Park is 25 years ago. The Shining is 38 years ago.
I wonder if there's organizations that campaign for films to make the list, be it the studios. It would have to be the studios.
The biggest thing they do is they preserve the film. So it'll always be kept safe and all that kind of thing. The old Night Trade, whatever the hell you call it, movies that could literally explode. Not any of these fit that bill. There are other ones in that list that might, but these ones don't. But we'll always, for sure, have copies of all these great movies. Although, I guess with DVD and Blu-ray, we do anyway. I should have said this already, some programming notes that we've got coming up. So, first of all, next week will be the last podcast of the year. We won't do one on the 31st. We need a week off between Christmas and New Year's. I've been editing a lot lately between the two different podcasts, this one and Scoring at the Movies. And then January will be the month of Bev all over again. We're going to have 3 episodes because we're going on vacation. And then, of course, February will be Oscar month. We're going to cover 3 Best Picture winners, and we'll do our Oscars preview show. So the format we've had for years will continue basically in 2019, but only one more movie left in the year for us. When we return in 7 days, it'll be Christmas Eve, so we are obliged to cover a Christmas movie. This one is 15 years old, and it's one of our favorites. Will Ferrell stars as Buddy in Elf. We covered Bad Santa a couple years ago, so that same year, 2003, 2 of the great Christmas movies, especially now that we've had 15 years to really get away from them and feel like, hey, they have entered the pantheon of classic Christmas films.
There's no question that Elf is beloved by just about everybody.
The coming attractions trivia, well, an opinion in this case, actually. What's Will Ferrell's best role? Ron Burgundy? Frank the Tank? Ricky Bobby? Harold Crick? Mugatu in Zoolander? Buddy in Elf? Or something else altogether? It's probably going to be one of those, in the opinion of most people. But which is your favorite of his roles? Which is his best one?
So for our answer to that question, check out our next podcast about Elf. But what if you just can't wait until then for more Ryan and Bev? Well, you could check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, you can check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered hundreds of movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and/or 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. But perhaps while you're there, in exchange, you could give us a rating and a review. If there's a movie that perhaps you'd like us to cover and you mention it in your review, well, we will seriously consider it. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT. That's all one word, TOP100. Project at checkout. Will we watch Mary Poppins again, Ryan?
I'm sure we won't, Bev. I'm sure we won't.
And cut.
So long, Superman. A booze hound named Bonnie is bidding me adieu as a plane kills me.